me by the water. Come on and join me, I'll be waiting by the shore. Stand in a circle with loving arms around you, yeah. Come to the river where the mighty waters flow. And as the river unwinds, you'll see the turns of your life. There we
you on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI, streaming over WBAI.org. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, an allegedly weekly program regarding science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund, and we're going to catch up on some movie reviews, and then our guest recorded about a week ago, Lawrence M. Shum. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. So, yeah, it's been like a month and a half since I have been able to address you. I was scheduled for a three-hour special to kick off the fundraising drive, and of course it would turn out that I was sick. I was really sick. I was nose-dripping, soppingly, yucky, blah, sick, and just could not do it. And it was also a little difficult because I didn't have a lot of notice that I was going to have that wonderful opportunity. I was hoping to actually get something toward the end of the drive so that I could tie into the sad 10th anniversary of the passing of Olivia Butler. But we are going to Octavia Butler. What am I doing, Olivia? For God's sake, what world am I living in? One in which hopefully Junie Butler would still be alive. But alas, it's been 10 years. And I was one of the last people to interview her. And it was quite shocking and a horrible thing. And something that we will get into ere long with some special guests. So it won't be exactly the 10th anniversary, but it's something that we're going to deal with. And then, for the other 4 weeks, should have been 4 weeks total, but it turned out to be five Wednesdays during which the fundraising drive occurred, I was simply preempted, plain and simple. So, what can I say other than, hello, we're back. And in that time, I have not been lackadaisical. I've recorded several interviews. The one that we're going to hear this week, I'll intro in a little while. And next week, unless something should happen that I do a live show, which, you know, a live guest could occur, Lev Grossman will be the guest. But in that same time, Dan Persons was not slack on movie reviews. And I'm afraid that the two that we have are a bit out of date. However, they are both still playing, and, you know, it's always interesting, even if it's a movie that you're not going to race out and see. I like reading reviews, even of films that I am not ready to race for. And although these are both very interesting, Kung Fu Panda 3, and I found 1 and 2 to be amazingly decent. And then The Witch, which is a movie by the title of which, if you will allow, I wouldn't go see, except that it sounds utterly fascinating, and it's not gory. It's, yes, it's frightening. Yes, it's got fear and terror in it, but it is not what it sounds like. It's not necessarily even technically really genre. But why don't we listen to the two reviews that Dan Persons had for us in February, and hopefully as of next week, we'll be back on the horse. Dan, if you're listening, I'd love to hear also what you have to say about Zootopia, which has gotten shockingly good reviews. Anyhow, here are two that we've missed.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It appears that somebody involved with Kung Fu Panda 3 took a look at Po, the titular Kung Fu Panda, voiced by Jack Black, and said, "You know, he doesn't really act like a panda." This has led to a good chunk of the second sequel focusing on how the supposedly last of the pandas discovers he's actually nowhere near the last, first reuniting with his father, voiced by Bryan Cranston, then returning to an isolated mountain village to discover a whole flock of anthropomorphized pandas behaving more in ways you'd expect anthropomorphized pandas to behave. They're cute, they're playful, they're fun-loving, they roll a lot, they eat a lot. They're Ewoks, essentially, and, well, I never had as much problem with Ewoks as many did, but if you're terminally allergic to the furry little cash grabs, these larger, roly-polier versions, however more convincing they are than costumed little people, probably won't sit well. Beyond that, there's another problem. Po was never a real panda to begin with, any more than Bugs Bunny acts like a genuine rabbit or Fred Flintstone acts like an actual caveman. So why start now? The movie struggles with this, creating some malarkey about how Po now has to discover his true nature, which even the characters in the film are confused by, since the previous two installments were also about Po discovering its true nature. Apparently, this is another true nature. If the franchise ever gets to Kung Fu Panda 4, maybe there'll be one more true nature for him to discover. Panda's going to be less in need of Kung Fu training than therapy after all of this, I think. There could have been something to this. In a more sophisticated treatment, this could have been an exploration of the tensions between personal identity, racial identity, and assimilation, since the bad guy here, a reincarnated yak spirit named General Kai, voiced by J.K. Simmons, is going around absorbing warrior chi and the warriors themselves into his own form. That issue could have resonated all the way through to the film's central conflict. The filmmakers either didn't bother taking advantage of the opportunity, or it somehow got lost in the rewrites. To their credit, the Panda Tribe is way funnier than the Ewoks ever were, and directors Jennifer Yeh, who also helmed the much better Kung Fu Panda 2, and Alessandro Carloni, keep the visuals dazzling and the action inventive. If the previous Kung Fu Panda leaned heavily on Jackie Chan-style martial arts comedy, Part 3 is all about Choi Hark-style epic action fantasy, complete with a battle finale set in a crazily surreal otherworld. The Kung Fu Panda franchise has been DreamWorks' showcase for CG animation and impressive 3D filmmaking, and Kung Fu Panda 3 at least lives up to that reputation. It's great to watch, it's entertaining, it's exciting, it's just not so much to think about. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com. Hour of the Wolf Movie Review, air date February 25th, 2016. The Witch, take one.
If only.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Here's an issue you don't usually think about when watching a movie. Is the camera being objective or subjective? Is it recording what's actually existing in the film's reality, however weird that reality may be? Or is it being filtered through the perceptions of a character or characters, and thus subject to that character's presumptions, prejudices, and very often delusions. The reason why we don't usually think about such things is that most films just go for the objective camera. What you see is what you get. Life's easier that way. And when they go for the subjective camera, that very often becomes a major part of the film's raison d'etre. First rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. The last rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about what's revealed in the final act. It isn't until the end of the excellent horror film The Witch that we find out the story is based on myths and legends of 17th century America, and that much of the dialogue is pulled from written record, presumably those that focused on a witch hysteria that was taking place in New England at that time. This raises an interesting issue. The story we're being told is about a family of Puritans whose adherence to their faith gets them exiled from their community and forces them to make a homestead in an isolated patch of land in the middle of a forest. We join the family just as things are going horribly wrong. Crops are failing, the youngest, a baby, vanishes, and it is strongly suggested that a malevolence in the forest, in the person of one or more witches, has targeted the family. But what are we actually seeing here? Director Robert Eggers, in making his impressive feature debut here, relies on those recorded accounts to present events as they would be perceived and understood by those of the time. There are no flashing power bolts, no morphing effects. The dread and horror is rooted and natural, depending as much as anything on the performances of an overall impressive cast. In particular, young Harvey Scrimshaw playing the adolescent son Caleb, who delivers an hysterical monologue that'll creep you out for days. But that grounding in historical record raises the question of whether events are being perceived through an objective or subjective viewpoint. The actual viewpoint character is the teenage daughter, Thomason, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. But is what she experiences the actual manifestation of a supernatural evil, or the brutality of the natural world tinted through filters of superstition, fear, isolation, and the 17th century equivalent of teen rebellion? There is, I think, enough evidence to suggest the uncanny is meant to be taken literally, most specifically in some sequences that could not have been witnessed by any of the family, and in such anachronisms as a seductress for Caleb, who looks more Renfair than period appropriate. But nothing lands so firmly that it couldn't be argued that these things are perceptions of minds being ravaged by grief and madness. It's that ambiguity that gives The Witch its unique and disturbing character and makes it the first great film of 2016. And I wanted to make note of a few other recent releases, catch you up on things if I could. If you can go with style over substance in your horror, then the new road movie-themed anthology Southbound is a lot of fun. There's not a lot of particularly innovative stuff in the interlocking stories, all set along or just off a barren stretch of highway located somewhere below, well, Atlantic City at the very least. The big standout is David Bruckner's nicely paced and brutally comic tale of a motorist trying to do right by the woman he's just run over, aided by the extremely dubious support of a group of 9/11 operators. That one's got a nice, nasty sting to it, whereas the others are more, okay, been there, seen that. The new home video release, Sociopathia, is more for horror fans of a certain stripe, mostly those who attend horror film fests primarily to worship at the feet, sometimes literally, of whatever reigning horror queens might be attending. One such, Ruby LaRocca, is co-director of this tale of a woman played by Nicola Fiore, who's a makeup effects artist by day, because in this reality the only jobs are in film, and a loony serial killer by night with a specialty in hot women. There's lots of gore, lots of lesbian sex, lots of bare boobies, and lots of bad acting. Basically, if you're still mourning the loss of Femme Fatale's magazine, this'll be for you. Others may fail to see the charm. As for real-world horror, you might want to check out the home vid release of Welcome to Leith, a documentary about a small, very small North Dakota town trying to fight a takeover by a group of white supremacists. It would be nice to say that the film offers a stirring vision of humanity at its best in fighting off an undeniable evil, but life isn't as simple as that, and directors Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker raise serious questions about how much Earth needs to be scorched in order to fight off some of the most loathsome but disturbingly committed examples of humanity. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Thank you, Dan. Now, those were, you know, now the idea of this horror movie, The Witch, to me, just the surface of it sounds like uh-uh. And yet, when one gets down to the nitty-gritty of what it is, it really sounds fascinating. So I did not see it on the big screen. It will come around soon enough, I am sure, on the streaming circuits and other such venues. And I do plan eventually to see it. So, and hopefully Dan will be back next week with new reviews. We will find out. Stay tuned. So, let's see. On the 26th of February, when, you know, whenever that was exactly, Lawrence M. Schoen came all the way from Philly over here to WBAI through an interview that was fostered through publicist James Gates, a wonderful person who used to represent Science Fiction Writers of America and is now into business on her own. And I'm very glad that she made this happen. I have known Lawrence for these many years and yet did not know a great deal about him, a lot of which I learned in the hour, 6 minutes, and 31 seconds that you are about to be subjected to. And if I started right now, I'll barely have time for an outro. I can tell you during the show, if you want, by the way, feel free to email me. I won't use the BAI address, because I rarely ever use it. You can write me on Facebook, Jim Freund, or go to the Hour of the Wolf forum if you are a member. If not, become a member. And or send me an email to jfreund, J-F-R-E-U-N-D, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. But enough of that chatter. Let's listen to the interview. And let's try that a second time, this time actually bringing the potentiometer up to its rightful place on the board. Good afternoon. That is at least for us who are actually recording in the afternoon. Us are Jim Freund and Lawrence Schoen. And today's date is still the 26th of February in the year 16. And we are in the recording studios of WBAI, as listeners can probably tell by the lack of soundproofing. So
those are added effects.
Yeah, well, it's the loop in the background.
Yes, you pay extra for that.
And for those who are not watching their radios, Schoen is spelled S-C-H-O-E-N, which in German would be Schoen, but I'm Freund of R-E-U-N. Let's not even go there. Lawrence has been on the program about four times for differing reasons, but none better than the current reason, which is the novel Barsk, B-A-R-S-K. Let me do that again. B-A-R-S-K. As long as we're enunciating, and let me go all the way off mic to get the book.
It's a lovely book.
It is.
But the subtitle of the book is
The Elephants
Graveyard. The Elephant's Graveyard.
I would have had it correct.
You
yes,
would have.
The Elephant's
Graveyard. You pause. And it,
yeah, so there is. I want to make sure there wasn't like another prefix. And that there's an apostrophe
pause.
After elephant. So
that's right. It's
multiple,
more than one elephant.
More than one elephant.
It's a big graveyard.
It's a very large graveyard because the font or font?
Font.
Font. Because the font are a great many people on a planet called
Barsk.
How about that? What a coincidence.
It's just lucky that way, you know.
But before we get to Barsk, an elephant, The Elephant's Graveyard, published by Tor Books in December of 2015 and available at all better booksellers near you, before we talk about that, a little background. Dr. Lawrence Schoen has... you're a doctor of what kind of linguistics?
Psycholinguistics.
What does that mean?
Officially, it's a PhD in cognitive psychology, but my specialty is language and memory.
Ah, okay. I love cognitive psychology.
It's good stuff.
It's great stuff. It's great stuff. Why are stoplights red instead of green, for example, is an area in cognitive psychology that I had to deal with when I was working on interface design. When you want to put something on a computer...
That's actually more a human factors question than a cognitive psychology question.
Well, human factors is a part, is a result, a product of the study of cognitive psychology.
Well, see, I would argue with that human factors is part of industrial psychology. And in fact, the program that granted me my doctorate had a specialization in industrial psych. And they train.
I think that would be a sub because we had two cognitive psychologists on staff when I was.
Oh well,
doing
sure,
this.
But they were just, you know, they were
just
dallying,
earning their living.
You know, yeah, they're trying to earn a living. I went.
One of them was also designing an exhibit for the Holocaust Museum, that's now in Washington D.C.
A fellow in school with me got a job with NASA designing the shape of windows in space shuttles and space stations.
Yeah, exactly. So it's cognitive
like, racket,
psychology is actually a fascinating, brilliant area. But
I think so, but I'm biased, obviously, because it's what I've devoted many, many years of my life to.
Yeah, and we should tell listeners what do they think cognitive psychology?
When spoiled for them? No. Cognitive psychology is a study.
Well, they have to read Barsk to find out.
There's a lot of cognitive psychology in Barsk, but I mean psychology is a study of human behavior, not just human, but general human behavior. Cognitive psychology is the study of cognitive processes that make up human behavior. So things like memory, attention, decision-making, these are all cognitive processes, language acquisition, and so forth.
Yeah, and intuition versus learned behavior, stuff like that.
We're getting into the fuzzy stuff now.
Yeah, well, it's the fuzzy stuff that I was working with years ago when I was in human factors and interface design.
Okay.
Which I wasn't designing, by the way. I was the network manager, but I was also the guinea pig.
Well, sure. Somebody's got to, you know, be wired up and shocked and
that,
all those
that
fun
was
things.
Basically
lied
it.
To. Yeah, it's
yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah. It was all it was great stuff. And I did actually get involved ultimately in web design and all that in the very, very, very early days of what would make it work.
Sure.
On CompuServe and Prodigy,
oh,
and then
geez.
Later on.
See, you should have called me. I'd have taken that gig.
And I did know you at that time. But at that time,
Thanks, Jim.
I didn't know your background.
I do it all.
At that time. What haven't we covered in your biographical background?
Well.
That you would like covered?
Well, those are two very different questions.
Okay. And yes, we will get to Paper Golem Press.
If you'd like.
That one I would definitely like.
Well, let me see. I have a SIG file on my email. They're gremlins in the building, clearly.
Yes.
So I didn't describe myself as an author, small press publisher, a psychologist, a Klingonist, and a hypnotist.
That's right, you're a hypnotist. Now, why? How? For what end?
Well, I've been writing about a fictional stage hypnotist for years.
That's right.
And, you know,
but I didn't know you practiced.
Well, I didn't at the time, and I hadn't been properly trained. I was kind of.
I've actually been hypnotized. I actually know what it's like. It's fascinating.
Everybody's been hypnotized. They just don't realize that it's happened.
Yeah, because they aren't aware of what real hypnotism is.
Right. So I'd been faking it based on my knowledge of cognitive psychology and so forth. And circumstances conspired a few years back where I had the time and the money and the opportunity to actually come up to New York and get trained and certified as a hypnotherapist.
Now, who certifies that? Because it's not a doctoral study. It's not.
It is not, and it's not that involved. I mean, it took about 6 days. But I cheated a little bit because I'm trained in what's referred to as Ericksonian hypnosis, which is, you know, named after Milton Erickson, probably the father of the American father of hypnotherapy.
Okay, having nothing to do with mesmer and those.
No. This is
the real thing.
Well, they were the real thing too, but it's a different flavor of thing. But Erickson's style, it's often called covert hypnosis because it's. Well, I'm sitting in the classroom and I'm listening, and I realized two things: that the style they were teaching me consisted of two parts. One, cognitive psychology, which I already had a doctorate in, and had spent, you know, 2 decades beyond that,
yeah,
working in the field, and the other part was storytelling. And I kind of knew something about that too. So for me, this was just taking familiar concepts, combining them, putting different labels on them, sort of the old wine in new bottles approach. So for me, it's been very, very easy to develop technique at this sort of thing. But right around the time that happened was around the time I sold a book to Tor, and my time dried up. So I rarely practice, and when I do, I mostly work with other authors who are having author issues. You know, they're getting in their own way as authors.
So hypnotism is what, you know, listeners who wouldn't know what the outside of the movie, you know, pop version of
popular pop hypnosis,
stage hypnosis.
Well, hypnosis as portrayed in the media has very little to do with the real thing. The better way to think of it is to talk about what is trance.
Yes, I was going to use the word meditation.
Trance is any time you become dissociated from your surroundings. So anybody who
Which
has
I'd like
been,
to be here at WBAI, but
well, anytime you're lost in a good book, you're watching a film and you forget that you're sitting in a movie theater, you're in trance. Anybody who, probably less common here in New York, but anybody who's been in their car driving home from work
and suddenly
you're pulling into the driveway at home and where'd the time go? You know, you're dissociated from your surroundings. Now, mind you, if something had run in front of the car, if someone in that movie theater had yelled fire, if you turned the page in the book and you know, there was a spider there, you'd have come out of trance immediately. You're aware of your surroundings. You just don't. You're just not focused on them. So you're still.
I'm totally aware of the times I was hypnotized.
Yes, hypnotized,
as David Letterman would say.
Absolutely. So that's basically your unconscious is taken over.
I've learned how to self hypnotize. It generally involves doing something enjoyable and repetitive. It could be a certain computer game that you don't have to think about.
And again, you're creating a dissociative state so that your unconscious is... We refer to this as bypassing the critical factor. Like, and I'll give you a simple example. If I were doing a stage show, which I don't, but if I were, and I brought you up from the audience and say you're standing to my left, I might ask you, would you mind standing to my right? And doing that, you know, it's a minor thing, but I get you to agree to something. And we're building what we call a yes set. You know, I'm getting you to say yes to me. So that when I start asking you more difficult questions, you are already predisposed to say yes. But I don't want to put anything direct to you that you might say no to. I don't want to engage the part of your mind, your conscious mind, that's going to answer yes or no questions. So I'm not going to ask you direct questions. I'm going to ask you indirect questions and make indirect statements that will get you thinking about something but aren't threatening because I'm not actually talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I might say, you know, you might find yourself falling into trance right now. Or you might not. I'm not saying that you are, and I'm not asking you to evaluate, but your unconscious mind has heard that and is processing that at an unconscious level, saying, I might be in trance right now. Huh.
And that's pretty much what happened to me was I didn't do the classic watch thing, but it was a question of my holding an object in front of myself with my elbow resting comfortably and watching that object and noting, oh, now it's spinning this way, now it's spinning that way.
Right, so we're directing your conscious attention to that. And now I'm going to... This is like classic misdirection.
And the phone would ring.
I'm going to sneak in from the opposite side, and the audience can't see the hand gestures I'm making
right now.
And I'm going to start saying things that will get processed by your unconscious mind. You may not be consciously aware of them, but that's okay. I don't want to talk to your conscious mind. I'm talking to the unconscious because that's where we can make some of the magic happen.
See, I remember because when I did this, it was for the purpose of quitting smoking.
Sure.
And so I remember the person saying... You know, cigarettes are really just, they help make you cough. You don't want to associate good things with smoking. It didn't work, by the way. I ended up, or maybe it helped, but it took me 10 years.
It's funny, because I know hypnotists who can cure most people.
I think it depends on the individual.
In one session. It does. The first question I ask, if someone were to come to me and say, I want to stop smoking, I say, I would come into my office...
Well, in fact, the hypnotist I saw said, we'll do two sessions if needs be. If those don't work, then you're not the subject.
Well, and more typically someone comes in for smoking cessation. I say, why do you want to stop smoking? And they say, I don't want to. My spouse wants me to stop. My response is, well, I can't help you. It's not your problem. It's your spouse's problem.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to quit.
Well, that was for me the thing is I didn't want to quit because even though it was killing me, I enjoyed it.
Sure, sure. There are still things that can be done, but if you don't want to quit, that's a harder row.
Yeah. No, it was very hard. It took me a little over 10 years to quit. It's been 11 years since my last cigarette.
Excellent.
But I ultimately went cold turkey.
Yeah. Well, and then eventually, you know, you'll
I got
you'll
sick
be
and I pulled the covers over
will
my
get
head.
You, you know, that's the way that works.
Well,
something's
going
to get you.
There's that. But I was living with a non-smoker and it was smelling on my clothes and I didn't notice. Anyhow, that's another program.
Different program.
But again, it's an interesting thing that you have brought into things that have made the writer Lawrence Schoen.
Sure. Well, again,
and that's really what we're.
And this is all.
I'm using misdirection here. Yes.
Bit. Well, no, you're bringing us back on track, like a good moderator or host would. So you know, there's lots of cognitive psychology in the new book. In the previous books, since the protagonist was a stage hypnotist, there was more and more. Particularly after I was certified, there was more and more legitimate hypnosis and hypnotic theory. With, you know, a science fiction twist to it. For the last 3 years, I've written novellas in this series, and one a year, and for one each year, they were nominated for the Nebula Award for Best Novella. This past year, I didn't write one in the series, instead this new book came out, so... I'm quite happy to have the best novel nomination instead.
Well, that's like best picture. I mean,
yeah, it's,
novellas,
it's...
short stories, and personally, I treasure the shorter form. To me, many of them are even more important than a lot of the novels that are out there.
I think that's a harder category. It's a hard because the competition. I mean, there's so many more things out there.
Exactly.
But where I was going with this is in the last novella, we use hypnotic regression as part of the science fiction gag that we were hypnotically regressing the ancestor of a Mayan priest to find out how they knew the aliens were going to come when the Mayan calendar reached its end, which happened a couple years ago.
Again,
yes.
How long is the cycle? About 800 years?
No,
something?
It's like 3,000 years. It's
3,000?
It's a big, long cycle, and... And they started in the middle of it. And that was one of the questions. And so part of the point of the story was, you know, someone had come and told them and had actually traveled from the future and given them the date. And the whole thing was set up and predetermined, and it made for a nice little story.
Yeah.
Did not win the Nebula. But, as they say, it's an honor being nominated.
Exactly. No, and that's true.
It's true. It is true.
It is true, because out of all them, their short stories.
Yeah.
I'm riffing on Out of All Them, Their Bright Stars, which is by Nancy Kress? No, it was a woman writer. Anyway.
Nancy Kress beat me that year for the best novella.
Oh, so, did she
yes,
now?
Yes,
did she now?
I have lost to Nancy 2 out of 3 years for best novella.
Yeah, oh, so she's one of those people. There are many people who get up and they when they get their award, they say, I'd like to thank Nancy Kress for not writing a story this year.
Very much so. and the year in between, Vilar Kaftan won. And in her acceptance speech, she thanked me because I had started a novella contest. And she wrote her novella, her award-winning novella, for that contest. So,
Oh, great.
That was my own damn fault, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I can't be mad at Nancy for winning, because Nancy was one of my teachers, along with Walter John Williams at the Strauss Toolbox. So I like to think I got the novella nominations in part because of what things I learned studying from Nancy. So,
and those are two of the best.
Yeah, good stuff. So,
I haven't seen a lot of fiction from Walter John Williams in a while.
He's been busy, but this past year he signed contracts for 4 books. So
I'm glad to hear that.
Expect stuff coming down the pipe.
Okay, because I'm a fan, big fan of both of them.
Walter is the master of plot.
I interviewed him once online in the early days of online chat for Ellen Dadlow, and Nancy I've interviewed for this radio program.
Excellent. Well, then I'm in good company.
And as a matter of fact, that's... about to come out on a CD, but that's still a secret. Anyway.
Okay, so you listening at home, don't tell anybody.
Oh, by the time they hear this, it'll be official.
Uh-oh, so this isn't coming out for ages.
This isn't coming out for a month.
Goodness. Well, who knows?
Or rather, the announcement isn't coming out.
I've been hit by a bus.
Oh, but and so you can quit smoking.
Yes.
But the... now... You are what some people would call, this is classic, the overnight sensation that's been, where overnight is like the Arctic or something.
Yes.
It's like been 30 years coming.
Something like that. Somewhere between 20 and 30 years I've been writing and selling and publishing. And
Getting nominated.
And getting nominated. But
this is not your first.
No.
But
no.
But having, there's something special.
Well, the
thing is that you can market a novel. Hard to market a novella.
This isn't my first novel either.
That's right.
This is my sixth book. It's my third novel. But it's my first book from one of the big 5 presses. All my previous publications have been from small presses.
Right.
So as far as Tor Books is concerned, I'm a debut author because, small press really doesn't count. And I understand that. That's a marketing decision, and that makes sense to me. So for the people who haven't seen my other work, they see my name on a bookstore, on a shelf, for the first time with Barsk. And so they say, wow, and it seems to be doing really well. And
they're paying more attention now because that novel category, it's a grabber.
One hopes.
Not saying that it's better or this or that, but it's more marketable.
It is more marketable, and it's the difference between big press and small press, of course. And Barsk has been generating a lot of nice buzz, particularly given as at this time that we're recording, it's been out for only not even 2 months, and yet somehow it came from behind, and it got the Nebula nomination for Best Novel. And so that's kind of extraordinary.
How surprised were you at that?
I wasn't surprised because...
I was surprised.
Well, I'll tell you why I wasn't surprised.
Although I helped nominate it. But...
I wasn't surprised because their CIFWA maintains a recommended reading list.
Right.
And Barsk had been trending, and in fact, at the time when nominations closed,
there were about 40...
I think I hit 35, but Barsk was in the lead of all the novels.
That's right.
And that was just crazy because 2 months before
I voted
exist.
Very late. I voted, it's like only 4 weeks ago or something, just before the nominations closed.
Now, it's hard to say what does that mean, though? I mean, because it's a recommended list, but it's...
It means that for me...
For you.
I can take a look there and see what the zeitgeist is.
Right.
Out
there. And that's the way I look at it. My thinking is...
And a lot of people do that with this new method of voting.
Particularly since, none of us have any time.
Right.
And you want to wait. You're trying to hedge your bets. And for me, making that list ending up so high, ending up at the top of the list in particular, when the nominations come out, or even before, as other authors are looking at, all right, I only have so much time to read. What should I read that is going to actually end up on the ballot so I can vote intelligently?
Yeah, so I go to the recommended list early, largely also to put things on that I want other people to consider.
Exactly.
And then I go on late to see what other people have recommended. Well, so I say, this deserves a push.
This was critical for Barsk because Tor published Barsk on December 29th, you know, 2 days before the end of the year. It barely crept in terms of eligibility.
Although the there's a service called NetGalley, which allows people, reviewers, critics, bloggers, to read books before the publication
date.
They
didn't have the entire book.
They had the first 12 chapters.
They had the first 12 chapters, yeah. And just enough to make you go, wait, what happens next?
Which is what you want.
Which is part of what I want, certainly.
That's when I read the first part of it.
But to be fair, also, I mean, Tor has been very helpful with marketing this book. And back in May of last year, I was one of four authors that they sort of packaged as the class of 2015, and they put me on stage at Book Expo America, and a few months later again at New York Comic Con. So, and we were giving away copies of the ARCs of this book, and you know, three other authors were doing the same.
Yeah, last year was actually, I think, the first year I didn't attend BEA.
You could have gotten that. You could have had a copy of Barth that much earlier.
And as is, this year it's in Chicago.
This year it's in Chicago right before the Nebula Awards.
Exactly, by coincidence. So just go to the Palmer Hotel and stay there.
And they tell me the Palmer House is actually is actually a little cheaper than the other BEA hotels. So this plug
and the
here,
Palmer House is a
really nice hotel.
It's very nice. Yes. For anybody who has ever seen a play or read the book or seen either of the movies of Showboat, the second half of it all takes place in the Palmer House.
It's a nice place. I wish somebody else were picking up the tab, but it is a nice place.
Now, I stayed there about 10 years ago for a month with somebody else picking up the tab.
Well, there we go. All right, then. I would stay there for a month if somebody else were picking up the tab. I might even stay for two. But
I was working in Chicago for a month. What can I say? It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, sure.
It's right near the Loop.
It's right near the Loop. It's right down the street from the museum, and it's big fun.
Great restaurants nearby.
Great restaurant. Oh, please. Ugh, I wish I had more time.
Yes.
My wife trains as a chef, so when we go to these conventions, you know, she's not as interested in the convention. She wants to do fine dining every night.
Yes, you should be on Scott Edelman's new podcast.
Scott and I and my wife go way back, and I know my wife has picked some good restaurants. When we go to a restaurant, typically at the Worldcon, we put together dinner parties at the Worldcon. We go to a restaurant, and Scott is there with his people.
Yes.
And we know we picked the right place.
But you know about his podcast.
I do. But Scott's crazy.
Well, yeah, I helped him choose what equipment to use that you could plunk down in the middle of a restaurant and record people
That's just wrong.
And so that is science fiction writers dining with Scott.
That's nice stuff.
Complete with me, you know, may I take the silverware? And you don't need that microphone anymore, right? You're finished with that mic. I'm waiting for that to happen. And
that'll
just
be nice.
Premiered, and he got a boost because Boing Boing promoted it. So.
I'm sure. No, Scott is a foodie's foodie. When we were in San Antonio for the Worldcon, he's going to hear this. For not remembering the name. There's a fellow who does barbecue in Austin.
More than one.
But there's a fellow that is world famous. And you line up at 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
He opens at 9. And there's more people in the line than he has brisket for. And so Scott, you know, we were in San Antonio. He rents a car. He buys a lawn chair. Throws it in the trunk of the car, drives up to Austin in the zero dark 30, you know, parks, sets out his launcher. At that point, he's like third in line, you know.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there waiting for the guy to open. And he's been blogging about this and tweeting about this, and the fellow recognized him and brought him in and gave him the tour. And
oh, that's cool.
Scott bought as much brisket as he was allowed to, and I didn't get any of it.
Oh, God.
I didn't see him till the next day. He just brought it back and was handed
out. Well, one of the reasons that I'm going to Worldcon this year, for the first time since the millennial PhilCon, that was Philadelphia 2000.
I was there.
I know you were. It's your hometown. But the I'm going to Mid-Americon, A, because Swanwick is guest of honor, so it's going to be good drinks, and B, because I always have to, it's my second opportunity to go to Arthur Bryant's.
Okay.
Which is the barbecue place for Calvin Trillin readers from his book American Fried. I brought that book with me to the first Mid-Americon and was passing it around on the train where there were a lot of fans going to the convention. And word grew because Calvin Trillin had written it up in The New Yorker and in his first book and all that. And the Friday night of the con, I was online. And this place is just a place with picnic tables and stuff like that. Mm. And they basically, you pick up the bread you want. You say, okay, I'll have a pound of the mutton or this or that. And they're cooking the sides right in the place. The pit is right there.
Sounds heavenly.
And it is. And their sauce is incredible. And we take a look. And near the back of the place walk in Paul Anderson, Harlan Ellison, and Robert Anson Heinlein in tuxedos. Having heard the rumors about this is the place, this is, I mean, the stink of the stockyard is quite noticeable from this place, and it's in an area best described as a ghetto. At least 25 years ago it was. I don't know what it's like today, but I will find out this summer.
Excellent.
And so nobody told them, no, it's not a tuxedo place.
Never hurts to add a little class.
Yeah, well, exactly. And they certainly did, but some of them at least had Harlan and Poole had the class to simply, like, take off the ties.
Got to take off the ties.
Yeah, you know, right. and settle
and
down.
Put a little sauce on the on your tuxedo jacket.
Let's discuss some food for thought now.
Okay.
Tell us about the universe that Barsk resides in.
Well,
And it's not new. I mean, you've been doing this for this world building for about 20 years?
Barsk actually started more than 20 years ago. And I actually, Barsk is a strange situation in that it is the first novel I ever wrote. Wrote the whole thing and tried to sell it, and it was horrible. Because it was the first novel I ever wrote, and I didn't know what it meant to be a writer yet. But
it stayed a trunk novel. It wasn't discarded.
It wasn't discarded, but I tried to sell it because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I didn't realize...
Did you have an agent
at that time? At various times during that attempt, I did have an agent. I had two different agents, and thankfully they didn't sell it. I didn't know how bad it was. I didn't know what I was doing. And I eventually realized, wow, this is... I mean, the ideas are awesome, but the writing's terrible, and every overused hackneyed idea I put in that book. So I put it away until I was a good enough writer, and then, you know,
which goes back to the teachers that you had mentioned earlier.
Absolutely. You know,
Nancy Cress, Walter John Williams.
I did James Gunn's workshop before that, and I wrote a lot.
Another Kansas connection.
Yes. So it's all, I mean, there's the saying, your first million words are practice. I needed to put in my first million words, you know, and some of those were other novels and novellas that sold, but that's just practice, you know, selling stuff. But then after I did Walter's, masterclass in 2010, and I worked with the techniques for a few years.
And where was that? Where does he teach that?
He teaches that was up at Taos, up on a 10,000 feet elevation.
Wow.
So it's a heady experience.
There are a lot of writers who like to find altitude. Le Guin apparently has been known to, like, use mountainside.
This was, you know, a ski lodge in the off-season, so I think he was able to get it cheap. Now, they're relocating this year and to somewhere nearby. I don't know if it'll be quite that high or not. But it was an amazing experience, and it transformed my writing, which is why, I mean, which is why Walter and Nancy are in the acknowledgments to the book. And you know the old expression, when the student is ready, the master will appear?
Mm-hmm.
I have a corollary for that, which is when the author is ready, the editor will appear.
Oh, well, that's hopeful.
It's might been my experience. So that it was my editor at Tor is Marco Palmieri, formerly one of the senior editors at Tor at Pocket Books in the Star Trek line, and that's how I knew him from my old Klingon connection. And years ago, it was at the when the Worldcon was in Reno, Nevada. Marco had just been hired at Tor Books. He wasn't even acquiring yet. He came up to my wife and I, and he said, "I'm taking you to dinner." And at dinner, he said those two words that every author wants to hear. Pitch me.
Okay.
And I pitched him four different books in various stages, including the trunk novel that at the time was Barsk. And he said, "That one. We're going to talk about that in 6 months when I'm acquiring it. It didn't
occur to me until now, but to say trunk novel is a pun.
Yes, but we just let that one go by.
Yes.
Too easy. Low-hanging fruit.
Should have, yes.
So I had this...
And we'll explain that in a minute.
I had the skill sets that I needed to then take that novel out of the trunk, out of storage, cold storage, and completely rework it. So it is my first novel, but it is a completely different novel from what it was. What it was.
And that's probably, in this case, a good thing.
Oh, God, yes. Absolutely.
So having said all that... give us a little bit of information about the world that was built for Barsk and some of the stories.
Well, let me tell you how I describe the novel.
Okay.
And I pulled out my cheat sheet here. So Barsk I describe as being about prophecy, intolerance, loyalty, conspiracy, friendship, a drug for speaking to the dead, also elephants in space.
Yes.
And
therefore, by the way, for listeners, now the trunk, now you get the pun trunk on the trunk.
Yes,
joke. Yes,
yes,
exactly.
Well, they should, the elephant's graveyard, the subtitle probably clued everybody in, but for the slow ones out there.
But yes. In this case, it's not that metaphorical.
It is not. The protagonists are in fact anthropomorphic elephants, uplifted elephants, if you will.
Yes. Now explain the up. I noticed that somebody who I don't think they knew what they were saying called it an uplifting novel, and I don't.
But bump.
I don't think.
No, they probably didn't. I like the term raised mammals. That's what I call them. RMs.
But
because David Brin kind of has locked in the term uplift, though he didn't invent it.
Yes, I thought he did.
I thought so, too. And then some science fiction scholars said, "Oh, no." And they pointed me to other sources. So basically, Barsk is set about 62,000 years in our future. There is no trace of humanity. Nobody seems to remember humanity. And we are in a galaxy that has more than 100 of these anthropomorphic species, uplifted or raised mammals, that have settled on hundreds of worlds throughout the galaxy. And 800 years prior to the start of this book, all the other races decided they didn't much care for the elephants. The elephants didn't look like them. They didn't have fur. All the other species had fur. The elephants had these weird trunks and these big ears and... let's just get rid of them. So they pulled them from all the other planets that they happened to occupy, and they gave them a world nobody wanted because it rained constantly. And if you have fur, you probably don't care for the water so much. So they gave them this world with very little land, just two, a frozen subcontinent and two archipelagos, and said, "Here, this is your world. Don't leave it." And that was okay with the elephants because they didn't mind the rain. And the islands of the two island chains were full of rainforest, and they built cities inside in the trees. So you have arboreal elephants because it's a beautiful image. And then they discovered in the rainforest pharmaceutical riches,
mm-hmm.
which the rest of the galaxy wanted. And included among these drugs was one that allowed you to speak to the dead. And there's whole physics behind that we can get into if you like. So suddenly, they reached an accommodation that if the elephants...
Yeah, we should explain it. It is actually given a scientific...
I do attempt to... I play fast and loose with the physics.
Right.
But the...
That's
the,
called science fiction.
The stuff about memory that it's based on is quite plausible. And that's drawing... I'm not a physicist, but I am a cognitive psychologist. So the memory stuff's, you know, pretty solid. So the deal was, we'll give you all the stuff you want. You leave us alone. And that has held. That's the compact, and that has held for 800 years. And at the time this novel begins, there is a portion in the government of the galaxy, the Alliance, that is unhappy with that monopoly, and they're trying to do something about it. And that becomes one of the major plot threads throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And there we go.
Yeah, I think that's a good enough.
Go read it.
Yeah, good enough. What's the word? Not tease.
A tease?
But, yeah, okay, that's call it a tease. Yeah.
Elephants in Space. If that doesn't hook you, you know.
Yes, it's like Mel Brooks' Jews in Space.
This Jews is elephants in space.
Exactly.
There we go.
Or Muppets in Space, Muppets what in have space. You. But this is Elephants. And how did people react when you were initially doing this to the anthropomorphization, because a lot of people complained for years about something that's very common in classic science fiction, about aliens not being alien. But of course, when one reads more into the book, you realize that's a little less alien than one may think.
You know, and I've been asked this a lot. One of the fun things about writing anthropomorphic characters is it's not all that different from writing aliens. We don't actually get anything in science fiction that is truly alien, because if it was, we wouldn't be able to comprehend it.
Right.
All right, so it has to be...
But that's what sometimes happens.
Sure.
2001 A Space Odyssey, explain the monolith. Not you, Mr. Clark, sit down.
Yeah.
But
So you want something that's weird and unearthly, but at the same time is alien. When you're dealing with anthropomorphic characters, you still go for that, but you also get to play with familiar animal characteristics. So they're alien, but at the same time, they're sympathetic and they're familiar. And that lets lets the reader relate to the characters a little bit more. The fun thing there is taking, you know, you do your homework. You look into the ethology. You look at what are the behavioral practices of these different animal species. And then you say, what would those turn into if these animals were sapient? So I'll give you one quick example. There's a scene in the book where one of our bad guys goes to visit a group of precognitive individuals that he has on staff. He set up a little institute to foretell the future.
Yeah.
And a large portion of them happen to be prairie dogs. And so he's pissed off, and he goes to meet with them. And he enters their building, and one is waiting in the vestibule for him. And he says, ah, you knew I was coming because you're a precog. That's why you're waiting here. And the prairie dog says, we knew you were coming, but one of us is always waiting here. Because if you know anything about prairie dogs, they always post a sentry.
Yes.
So if you know that about prairie dogs...
A lot of ground animals, meerkats,
right,
prairie dogs.
Right. So it's just what you get when you uplift a prairie dog. They know what they're doing, and it becomes part of the society, and we have language for it.
We mentioned the term and the derivation. Have we explained to listeners what uplifting an animal means?
Uplifting, for my purposes, in the purposes of Barsk, is, they have language. They have what we might call human-level intelligence.
It's endowing them with properties that they do not currently have.
That's correct.
And helping bring them generally into a sentient.
Makes them tool using. I don't think I explicitly state that they all have opposable thumbs, but they do.
Okay.
The font, the two species of elephant that make up the font, the lox and the eleph, have in effect a third hand in their prehensile trunks, which comes in handy. No mm-hmm. pun intended. And there you go.
A handy trunk.
A handy trunk. There we go.
Yes.
Shameless.
Yeah, it truly is, yes. But that's not new for either of us, is it now?
No, indeed not. So, and but that's part of why they are abhorred by the rest of the Alliance, because...
Because they pun. No.
Because they've got that extra hand, you know? It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
So...
Appendages.
Appendages, you know? They shouldn't do that. So, there you have it. And they have no fur. That's also really disturbing.
So, to come back into outside of that universe, because it's, I should add, by the way, the book isn't just fun sci-fi or anything like that. It's quite emotional in parts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and in fact, I'll also...
Which is something people might not have expected.
You know, there's the expression, write what you know. And the very first version of this book, very early on, our protagonist is one of the people who can speak to the dead, and he is speaking to his best friend, who is dead, and who he believes committed suicide. And in an earlier version of the book, I described the suicide. I wrote it out, and his friend plunges from a great height. He falls from the very top of the canopy in the rainforest all the way down to the ground and is killed. And the first time I wrote it, no pun intended, it fell flat. And I went and rewrote it, and I had him set himself on fire first. And the reason that came, I mean, that's horrific, but the reason it I was able to write it better.
And by the way, we're not doing much in the way of spoilers here, because it's early on in the book.
But what nobody's going to know unless they hear this podcast, this radio cast, rather.
Broadcast.
What a sexist term.
Is
that when I... This was my first year or two of teaching as a college professor, and one of my students committed suicide by immolation.
Oh, my God.
And then I rewrote this scene. And suddenly it had all the weight, all the gravitas that... It should have had, because it was suddenly real for me. And that's the first time I really came to terms with that expression, write what you know.
Wow.
So, there you
that's
go.
A pretty...
Yeah. Don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where that comes from. And... Whew.
Yeah.
Kind of takes the tone down for you, doesn't it?
Well, it's intriguing. You know, I mean, one of my problems with today's science fiction and pop culture in general is that it all has to be so, not just solemn, but breastfeeding. Everybody, all your lead characters have to be tortured individuals and in one way or another. And
no, I don't. It's not realistic. Life doesn't work that way.
But pop culture at the moment does. And science fiction is very much...
I make a distinction between science fiction and what I call sci-fi. Things that are on the big screen are sci-fi.
Okay, you know what?
Explosions and car chases.
I agree with that distinction. I'm one of the few. I've given it up because people...
They don't want to hear it.
They don't want to hear it.
Well, as science fiction has become more mainstream...
That's why I say sci-fi or skiffy, to make fun of the term sci-fi. But I'm with you.
Okay.
For the listening...
I haven't seen you at the meetings.
But but just for the listening audience, sci-fi is a term that was coined by Forrest J. Ackerman specifically to refer to monster movies of the 1950s, and he wanted to distinguish it from good science fiction. It was intentionally a put-down, just as the term The Big Bang was supposed to be an ironic term by somebody who didn't believe it.
Yes, and people don't realize how small a quantum leap actually would be.
Yeah.
But we're not going to go, because it's such a cool-sounding phrase, so...
It is.
There we go.
It is, and that's why people, I think, use sci-fi. But having said that, yes, I recognize a distinction.
Well, you know, you cannot... I mean, human beings, and I would argue my uplifted creatures as well, cannot maintain that kind of emotional response for very long. The physiologically, we're not built for that. We have that fight or flight experience.
Mm-hmm.
We attack or we run away as fast as we can, and then we not only revert to baseline. The pendulum keeps going the other direction. We crash. We recover. We can't sustain that. You can't be red hot mad at somebody for very long. You cannot wallow in anguish for very long. Eventually, it's going to tire you out. You have to stop. Now, ironically, the only character I think who's really tormented or anguished much in this book is a young boy who cannot feel pain.
Right.
And he doesn't know. He's rowing a boat somewhere for hours upon hours upon hours. And he's in the rain, and his hands are wet, and he just assumes, you know, it's the rain. And he doesn't realize that he has blistered his hands, and the blisters have burst, and there's blood running down his hands, and because he can't feel any of it. And it's just horrific, I mean, what he's done to himself physically, but he doesn't know, and he's not worried about it. Scares the bejesus out of the readers, mm-hmm. And my wife says, "Why would you do this to him?" I said, "He did it to himself."
Exactly. People need to remember to distinguish fiction and
well, you know, that. this is.
But then again, that's not it, because when people are reading a good book and get drawn into it, they might find themselves in a
trance. There we go, as they should. Though the other piece of this, though, of course, and I've ruined television for my wife because we'll be watching some show. You know, the madman with the gun has gone into the hospital, and he's standing on this big bridge in the hospital, and the snipers could take him out at any time, but they don't. Why?
Because
it's television. It doesn't serve the author's need. It's not about the character's need or being true to the character's motivations. It doesn't serve the convenience of the author.
I learned all of this stuff at a very early age. I mean, you know, single-digit age, when my family would be at home watching Perry Mason, and I would say whodunit, and I would, we always knew that, you know, the person being tried that week was innocent because it was Perry Mason, but I knew whodunit.
Oh, yeah.
How? Very simple.
Well, it's always the name actor who's brought in, you know, and for one thing. That just spoils TV.
It was an actor that at age 8 I could recognize. If I could recognize that actor at age 8, they done it.
You paid more for that guy. He's going to have to give more lines.
Yeah. Showed up in that scene in the beginning. You know they're going to use that person.
I was watching something just the other night, and our heroes are running through the desert, and the camera is focused on a cactus that they run past. And I say, "Look, it's Chekhov's cactus." You know, before Act 5, we're going to shoot that cactus, you know. And in fact, they go and they say, "Well, the cactus, it
by
has..."
By the way, we're not discussing anybody on a starship when we say Chekhov's cactus.
Well, we might. We could.
If Anton Chekhov should ever turn up, yes.
Anton Chekhov, and the Turkey City lexicon refers to it as the fish on the wall.
Right.
You know, if there's a fish on the wall in Act 1, someone must shoot the fish by Act 3 or 5 or something. So,
yeah.
It's...
There was, in fact...
Unless it's a red herring.
I saw a play. I think it was a staging of a Tom Stoppard play, and it wasn't in the text. But in that play, they very prominently showed a gun on the set, and they kept having different characters pick it up and hold it, and then put it back, and never got fired. Yes. And that is, you know, just in order to put the lie to Chekhov's law.
Sure. But when it's done so overtly, you know, it's like, why is that? There is a understanding between an author and the reader, between a good author and the reader, that if in the first chapter of a book I introduce you to a name and give dialogue to 5 different characters, those are the characters that are going to be worth watching. Those are the characters that are going to do something in the book. If I'm reading, a beginning author sends me a manuscript and there are 30 named characters in the first chapter, you know, it's like, too many. They cannot all be important to this story. It's too complex.
Which sometimes means they'll all get killed off,
but then,
except for 2 or 3.
Then, you know, there's only so much cognitive load. I can only remember so many names.
Or killed off, sifted out.
Right. Don't waste my time, my processing time, because I'm like an infant discovering the world. What's important? What do I need to know about? Is that sound important? No, that sound is a benign sound. It's okay. That other sound, that's the sound of an oncoming car. I really want to be attentive to that. That other sound, that's the sound of the lawnmower. Yeah, want to know when that's coming my way. The can opener? No, let the dog worry about that. That means we're opening dog food. That's not my business.
And this is radio. Where we're here, we get voices and all, but
which is why we're talking sounds and not other stimuli. So, you know, a reader is trying to figure out what's important. an author, a good author, should be signaling some of this to say, I'm introducing you to the characters that are going to be significant. I'm not going to distract you with characters that have nothing to do with the story, because that squanders your limited cognitive load.
See, now there's somebody who's really studied this stuff talking about it. I think there are a lot of writers who work differently, and possibly to their detriment, to the detriment of their work. In some cases, it's fun. You know, that red herring, sure. That thing that comes out later. The character who's introduced in the beginning, who we soon forget about, and then absolutely. Comes in Act 3.
That's wonderful stuff. Absolutely. Foreshadowing is good stuff if you can do it. And finding the right balance. And it's going to be different for every reader, of course. Some people aren't going to catch it the first time at all, and they're going to be stunned and think you cheated. Other people are going to see it coming. It's why I don't do mysteries, because, you know, no matter how good a mystery writer you are, there is that narrow band, I think, that you're going to capture. Some people are not smart enough for the level you're writing at. Some people are too smart. You need to find who your audience is and write for them. And that's fine. But those things work if you play fair.
Mm-hmm.
You have to play fair with
the reader. That's an essential rule in all genre literature.
And if the reader has to work too hard to figure out what's going on and what's important, they're not going to finish the book. They're going to throw somebody in the hallway or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just threw somebody out of the room. I hope you all appreciated
clearly,
that.
Clearly, because they were not getting
it. Was not a member of management of mm-hmm. WBAI, however.
Well, not yet, but...
future management.
So this is the contract I think an author has with the reader. Now, there are some people who can break that contract very effectively. And I'm thinking of George R. R. Martin as a classic example. You know, you read the first book, you read Game of Thrones, and I tell you, all right, this
you
is
know
my
the
protagonist.
Hero is Ned Stark.
Ned Stark is my hero. Wow, they're about to cut off his head.
We're going to do a spoiler.
Ned, how are you going to get out of this? Ned, your head is rolling across the floor. How are you going to get out of this? And yet he made it work. I don't know how. I don't ever expect to be a good enough writer to pull off what he did there. I was sitting in awe. I said, you've shattered the contract, and you're like, I want to keep reading.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then he does it over and over and over again. And you just go, oh, come on! So I am in awe of what he can do. But this is also a man who's been at it for a very long time, and he's worked in television, and he understands...
He's another person who's an overnight sensation for over 35, 40 years.
Absolutely.
And what, 3 TV series?
Yeah. He understands that not only are there rules, but that when you truly understand the rules, you can then break them selectively to incredible effect.
And he's a true scholar at it.
Yeah.
He knows.
It's effortless, and it's such a pleasure reading his work for that reason.
Yeah. We should actually start drawing to the closure of the program.
Good. I like closure.
Yeah, closure is excellent. So a few things. We will end reiterating the title and all that. We have not at all discussed Paper Golem.
We have not discussed Paper Golem. Paper Golem is the small press I started a number of years ago, and I had one huge advantage with this small press. And that is, it was not intended as an income stream. The running gag in small press publishing is, the question is, you know how to make a small fortune with a small press? Yes, start with a large fortune.
Yes.
I went into this with the first book, and I went to my wife, and I said, there's this book I want to do, and I think, worst case scenario, I will lose $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
Are you okay with that? And she said, yeah, if it's what you want to do. Now, Paper Golem breaks even. Barely, usually, now.
Is that with or without a salary for yourself?
I take no salary.
Okay,
no.
So it needs to be pointed out that some people can say something breaks even
yes.
after they pay themselves.
I don't get paid. My co-editor in some of the series doesn't get paid. The authors get paid.
The authors do.
They get
paid professional rates.
Not so much, no.
No?
No, no. Generally less than professional rates, but they get offered a higher royalty rate. But It is not a pro market in that sense.
Ah, okay.
And it's not supposed to be. I started.
So it's what in the award circuit they would call semi-pro.
I think it'd be called semi-pro. Yeah, yeah. Its purpose wasn't to get you a publishing credit to apply towards CIFWA membership. There have been two different main production lines. One is we've done a series of single author collections, where I have picked out authors near the beginning of their career and said, wow, this author is going places. They don't have a book out yet.
And this is a great thing because...
Let's give them a book to hold up at a convention and say, here's my book.
Because there's some very, very good writers of short stories that are not working on novels. They go to an agent, they go to a publisher, and they say, this is great stuff. Come back when you have a novel.
Yeah. So we've done three of these over the years, and I will plug each of their names because they've gone on to do amazing things. The first of these was Kat Rambo, who is the sitting president of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America. Yay, Kat! And her first novel came out in 2015. She's had two other collections since.
Although when she was on this show, she had already done lots of short stories.
Lots of short stories.
And that was a few years
she's
ago.
Had three collections, but I did her first, and it was a very nice collection. Eric James Stone has his first novel just came out.
He's the only one whose work I don't know.
You should get to know it. He actually picked up the Nebula Award a few years ago for, I think it was a novella, or it could have been a short story. It's a blur.
So maybe I have
very
read
good
them
stuff.
Because
yeah.
when works are nominated, voters and those who are allowed to nominate get free access.
Absolutely. It's a good book. And he writes wonderfully well. And more recently, did Tom Doyle's first collection. And Tom had his second out of three books in a series come out from Tor just last year. So
And Tom, when his collection came out, did an episode of Hour of the Wolf in which he read one of the stories, which was just absolutely wonderful. And he's, as we were talking off air, oh my God, is he a reader who punctuates vocally?
Yes, Tom is a delight. So that was one product line. The other product line was the Alembical series, which is an anthology series of original novellas. Because at the time we started it, there just weren't markets for novellas. And I said, well, let's fill that niche.
Yeah, there was for a brief time at Ace Books when Terry Carr was the editor, he might put out a volume with three novellas in it.
But then there were a long time ago.
And at
that
same time, there were Ace Doubles.
Well, also
novellas and novelettes.
At that time, a novel was 65,000 words, and you know, we left that number behind quite some while ago.
Yeah.
More recently, another small press started doing novella anthologies. They have since, I think, stopped and gone out of business. Several online websites have bought novellas, and a couple years ago, Tor.com started buying novellas.
Yeah.
And at that point, I said, well, Tor.com has more money and better editors and wider distribution. I can stop. My job is done here.
I disagree.
But not all that long ago, they're a victim of their own success. They have closed to unsolicited submissions.
Right.
So that novella market.
And that's
kind of
I'm not sure if that's true of Clark's World. I believe it may be true of Lightspeed.
I don't know. Novellas, I mean, that's a lot of words.
Well, I work at Lightspeed, so I should know.
You should know.
But I do the podcast end.
So, I mean, I'm always, those of you out there in the listening world who are writers, I'm always reading for novellas for the next issue of Alembical.
And how would people go to a place where they could?
Well, if you go to papergolem.com and click on the submissions tab, you will find our submissions guidelines. They're very simple, and yet people screw them up. and they are very specific as a shibboleth to see if you can follow directions. Because if you can't follow these three simple directions, honestly, I don't care how good your novella is, you're going to be a pain in the butt to work with.
Yeah, which is something that people always, if you're going to be sending anywhere, RTFM, in this case, RTFG, read the friendly guidelines.
I even explain about it being a shibboleth in the guidelines, and why it's a shibboleth. And I mean, it's simple things like Rule number two, we're reading novellas. We are defining a novella as between 20 and 40,000 words. Do not send me your 17,000-word manuscript. Right. I will not read it. Do not send me your 65,000-word manuscript. I will not read it. And don't complain to me when I send it back to you saying I didn't read it.
Yeah. Oop. And that means my phone has gone off of silence, which means that we are actually nearing the end of our time here.
Thank God, because...
So let's do the takeaways.
The takeaways.
Yes. First of all, your website.
My website is lawrencemschone.com.
And that's LawrenceMschoen.
.com.
Yes. Spelled D-O, no, but...
If you can spell my name, you can order my books, and you can go to the website.
Yeah, and that should also take you to Paper Golem Books.
No, it won't, actually.
Oh, you should put a link there.
I really should, but I'm just not that together.
Oh, okay. You ought to put a link there.
And again, you
but
know...
But Google Paper Golem Books.
Self-selection going on here, Jim. You know, if you can't figure this out...
And by the way, it's Golem, not Gollum, so...
No, indeed. Yes. It is. Though it is precious to me.
It may be. But most currently, most happily, most importantly, the book at hand is Barsk.
Barsk, the Elephant's Graveyard.
But if you just look for B-A-R-S-K online or in the bookstore in the science fiction section under Shown, you will, B-A-R-S-K on your preferred search engine, browser, whatever it may be, you will be led to any number of places that we'll talk about, and some will sell you the book.
I should also from add Tor Books. That there is an audio version available from available on audible.com from Macmillan Audio, and it is narrated by the brilliant actor and director J.G. Hertzler, who your audience may know as the actor who portrayed General Martok on Deep Space Nine. So I have Klingons reading about elephants.
So you don't know what he looks like, but you do know what he
sounds
like.
No, I'd met John some years ago. He has, as I said, he's a director. He had a small production company that got tapped to do the DVD extras on the, I guess it was the 20th anniversary.
Well, at BAI, we had Rene Auberjonois walking around occasionally because he was doing one of our radio dramas called Poisoned Arts. And somebody looked at him, and this is right when DS9 was on TV, and he took one look at him, and they said, Benson! Too much makeup.
Yeah, that's a shame. Well, you hear his voice, though.
And then there are those people who go, you were the chaplain in MASH. Which he was. The movie. Yes. Dago Red. Dago Red was the name of the character.
All I remember is we're the pros from Dover.
I haven't watched that movie in 2 days.
But where I was going with this was J.G. Filmed the extras for Star Trek VI at a convention. And actually, I was there, and they brought me in and said, he wants to film you, talking about Star Trek and Klingon and Shakespeare. So I had met him then and was able to reach out to him and bring him onto this project. And he does a phenomenal job reading the book. So I hope your listeners will go out and find it. Right now, as you've mentioned, it's been nominated for the Nebula Award. I'm hoping it might even, by the time this airs, be up for a Hugo nomination. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, Hugo nominations, by the way, have just opened.
Yes.
And all you have to do to nominate and vote for the Hugos is become a supporting member of the World Science Fiction Society. Just Google that up. Don't be a puppy. Just Google that up and nominate and vote.
There you go.
Vote your conscience, I will tell everybody.
You say vote for books you think are good books.
Yes, exactly, and not somebody's slate. Well, that's a whole other story. Definition. We're not getting near there.
What I like to tell people is I would never ask anybody to vote for me because that's the book's job.
Oh, very well put.
You know, if the book speaks to you, it says vote for me.
Yes.
And I think...
Well, it spoke to enough members of your peers, to the science fiction and fantasy writers of America.
I am very flattered and honored and humble, and I don't do humility well. I am.
No, but to me, I mean, the Hugo is nice. It's a popularity fan award.
The Nebula is it.
It's the peer award.
It is, and it's as good as it gets. And I'm so very, very flattered and honored to have been nominated for it. I don't think I'm going to win, but if
hey, your name's there.
My name is there, and if the community decides
if people go to the happily accept the award.
If
people go to the CEFWA website and take a look at the history of the Nebulas, they will see all the nominees from every year. So it's not just the winners.
Yes. Yes.
That is a fact.
Wikipedia is very good about that as well.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
So, again, thank you, Lawrence M. Schoen, for being here.
Jim, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And this has been Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund. You can contact me through Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, or I guess one can send emails there, or better yet, send real email. I'm jfreund, J-F-R-E-U-N-D, at ourwolf.com, and I'll be glad to hear from you. Next week, unless we end up doing a live guest, which is always possible, I like to play fancy, free, and footloose. Our guest should be Lev Grossman, who I recorded late last week, author of The Magicians and Consultants, of the TV show based on his trilogy. At any rate, stay tuned for actual radio, instead of just pitching, Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves. Thanks for listening. Have a good week, and please, folks, be good to each other. They deserve it, and you deserve it. Good morning.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. piece of cloth that's off the way I see it while I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and blue just spit on you.
Distraction, global warming, birth deforming. It's a corruption eruption. Corruption eruption. It's a corruption eruption. It's a corruption eruption on this island.
How drug.